I will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, though.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken, so to speak.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsors, Old School Labs and Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding themselves, and we also talk about the history of the sport of bodybuilding. And on today's show, we're going to have a throwback episode. This interview was actually done in 2015, 4 years ago already. It was the first time I talked to Boyer Coe, who, of course, was one of the great bodybuilding legends of our time. He's a four-time Mr. Universe. He was a Mr. America winner. And then he was a major force in the IFBB, always placing high at the Mr. Olympia contest for many, many years. And Boyer talks about his whole career in this interview. So we're going to have part one of our interview up today. And then next week we'll have part two. But Boyer was a great champion. He's always one of my favorite interviews because he's got great stories. He's very articulate, real Southern gentleman, and very honest. So you're really going to love this interview. At the end of the show, I am going to continue my new segment of the show where I'm reading an article from an old bodybuilding magazine. So this time we're reading from Muscle Builder and Power. This was the February 1977 issue. And this article is called The Charisma of Bodybuilding. And it's a really, really great article. It's written by Jack Neary, who was a great writer for Joe Weider. Along with Rick Wayne, Jack was one of the best writers that Joe had. And this article talks about a posing exhibition that Arnold and Robbie Robinson did in late 1976. It was right after Robbie won the Mr. Universe in Montreal, Canada. And Arnold, of course, was retired for about a year. And he was down in weight. He was only about 215 pounds, 210 pounds. But he did a lot of guest posings in 1976. And this was before Arnold's movie career really took off. I think Stay Hungry was released in 1976, but Pumping Iron was not released until the next year, 1977. And then, of course, Conan was not released until 5 years after that, 1982. So Arnold was still a bodybuilder. He was in transition from going from bodybuilding to acting. And this article is really about him, and it really talks about the fun they had traveling. So you're really going to love this article. So this will be after our Boyer Coe interview, so be sure to stay tuned to the podcast and don't turn it off, because I'm going to read this article from the February 1977 issue of Muscle Builder Magazine. You're going to love this. All right, I want to mention right off the bat, we are brought to you by Old School Labs, and I've been with Old School Labs for several years now. This is the supplement company that draws on the wisdom of the golden era of fitness and bodybuilding to offer unique supplements for the discerning athlete. I'm talking no proprietary blends, no artificial flavors or sweeteners. You may have heard of their award-winning fat burner Vintage Burn, which is the world's first muscle-preserving fat burner, or Vintage Blast, which is the world's first two-stage pre-workout. Old School Labs is the only brand that I use, trust, and associate my name with. They're the brand I used to win the Natural Mr. Universe in 2012. They're also the company that sponsors Breon Ansley, who is the 2017 Classic Physique Olympia champion and 2018 Classic Physique Olympia champion. They also sponsor 1983 Mr. Olympia Samir Banute and bodybuilding legend Tom Platz, and they also brought on Chris Cormier. So use the discount code LEGENDS12 when you go to oldschoollabs.com, and you will get 12% off your order. Old School Labs, supplements that make sense. All right, and speaking of Old School Labs, I was supposed to head out to California in another week to do an interview with Tom Platz, but unfortunately that has been delayed, so I will not be going out to California this month, unfortunately. I was really looking forward to that. I was looking forward to going to Gold's Gym and training with Phil Williams again and seeing who's out there, seeing my friend Aaron Reed and Tito Raymond and all those guys, but unfortunately, that will not be happening. I am going to Colorado, though, and that'll be the weekend of the Arnold Classic, which is the first weekend in March. So I made my plane trip for that, and that's with the AAI organization that I was going to last year. So this will be their first big event of the new year of 2019. And Colorado is a beautiful place. It's Colorado Springs, and it's at the Biltmore Hotel, which is like 100 years old. and it's a really iconic hotel where all these politicians have stayed and movie stars have stayed. When I went there last year, I guess Arnold had just been there a couple weeks before me. So it's really, really an awesome, awesome hotel. So I'm looking forward to going out there. It's beautiful, beautiful scenery. What else is going on? I hope you guys saw the Super Bowl yesterday. Actually, 2 days ago. It was on Sunday. Kind of a boring Super Bowl. It wasn't a high-scoring game. I figured the New England Patriots would win. Of course, it would have been a lot better if the Chicago Bears would have been in there. But unfortunately, they got eliminated on their first playoff game. So hopefully the Bears will do better next year. But congratulations to the New England Patriots. Unbelievable dynasty they've had. And you got to give credit to Tom Brady and Bill Belichick for the expertise they have. And Brady really is the GOAT. He's really the greatest of all time. He's amazing. 41 years old. And I think Bill Belichick also was the oldest coach, oldest Super Bowl winning coach in Super Bowl history. So just goes to show you, age is just a number. So congratulations to both of those guys and to all the New England fans. Great, great victory. All right. I got some great emails last week from the Pat and Eve interview. It was really well received. So I'm going to read those in a second. And I do want to mention also the Ed Corney tribute that we did right after he died on January 1st. I think we did it like the second week in January. And we had our interviews with Mike Katz and Roger Schwab. I have now converted that to video. So if you're on my YouTube page, check it out because I've added a lot of video clips and a lot of pictures. So it looks really, really cool. So I'm trying to convert all these podcasts to video, but it's just taking some time, especially with my busy schedule working full-time. But I finally got this one done. This was a lot of work because it had a lot of pictures I wanted to add, and I got some video from the movie Pumping Iron that I put in there. So check that out when you get a chance. That's on my YouTube page. Well, I want to send a congratulations to my parents who just celebrated their 59th wedding anniversary last Wednesday, January 30th. And my mom and dad have been married now for 59 years. Next year will be 60 years. They got married in 1960. I think my dad was only in his early 20s. And my mom was, I think, 18 years old when they got married. So great, great parents I have. I'm very, very lucky, very blessed. And I'm very happy that they are very healthy. In fact, they were in Maui when they celebrated their 59th wedding anniversary. They went out there for 3 weeks, so they missed that huge cold spell that went through Chicago last week where it was like 25 below or 21 below. It was crazy, crazy weather. So they missed that. They got home right after that. So my brother went out there with his wife, and he got the chance to visit them. And I think my cousin Terry also went out there, and she visited them. So they had a great trip. So congratulations to their anniversary, and we will be celebrating number 60 next year. It seems like we just celebrated 50, so I can't believe how fast time is flying by. We're already now in February. And speaking of the time, I looked at the calendar. There's only 16 weeks till summer. If you look at Memorial Day as being the beginning of summer, we've got less than 16 weeks. So again, I'm doing my consultations online at my website, dadbodtoripbod.com. Or you can just email me, if that's easier for you, at naturalolympia@gmail.com. And I'm setting up training and nutrition programs, and I will follow you every week. So it's not like one of those programs where I just send it to you and then you're on your own. I actually follow up with you every week. I make sure that you're making progress. So if you're interested in that, send me an email at naturalolympia@gmail.com. Or like I said, just go to my website, which is dadbodtoripbod.com. And you can just fill out the form right there online. And I'll get you guys going if anybody wants to get ripped for the summer. I know it gets more challenging, especially for us older guys. But if you want to do that, or at least just send me an email. Let me know what you're trying to accomplish. And we will get you going for the summertime. Summer out here in Florida all the time. But for those of you people that live in the colder states, you might want to check that out. I do want to mention my sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine, has a new supplement. It's a fat-burning supplement, and it's called the Magic Pill. And it says everyone is looking for that magic pill, right? Well, here it is. Developed and backed by science, this formula was made by chemists and expert formulators working with Florida Alternative Medicine. This is a revolutionary fat-burning product, and it's getting rave reviews from athletes all over the country. So if you're interested in getting a month's supply of this amazing fat loss pill and thermogenic, the cost is $39.99, and you can just call Florida Alternative Medicine today. And their number, of course, is 813-922-8939, and you can order yours, the magic pill. So check that out if you're interested in getting in shape. All right, I want to read some of these emails that we got from our Pat Neve interview last week. Pat is a very popular guy, and the interview was very well received, and he got a lot of emails on the about the site from his friends and his fans. Richard Baldwin, who is a friend of Pat, says, "When I was texting with Pat, he said he was nervous about doing this podcast, but I assured him John knew enough about the history of bodybuilding to ask the right questions, and Pat seemed to lose any qualms about being interviewed, and as always, John did a great interview. These interviews are so important to the history of the sport, as John captures history and the voices of those men themselves." So thank you, Richard, for saying that. And Pat responded, and he said, "Thanks, Richard, for the advice. I had fun doing the John Hansen podcast. Stay healthy, my friend." And Richard said, "Will do, Pat. You did great, just like I told you you would. It couldn't have gone any other way, champ." Moisey Richardson said, "The dude is huge." Jeff Preston, my old friend from rawiron.com. Check out Jeff's website, rawiron.com, if you want to check out some really great old pictures of bodybuilding. Jeff said, "Another great interview, John. Thanks, Pat, for doing it and sharing your stories. I know I'm speaking for us old iron slingers when I say we love it." Brian Semple said, "I appreciate these interviews. They fill in the gaps for me, and they offer insight to a sport that I've been following since the 1970s. Chuck Mirabilli said, "Absolutely great interview. I loved it, Pat. You did a great job. What a great career. I'm so proud of you. Again, especially for being a great guy." Phil Bradshaw said, "Pat, you be the man." Bill Frazee said, "I really enjoyed the interview." Tom Terwilliger said, "I met Pat while judging the AAU World Championships in Vegas last year. If I wasn't a fan before that, which I was, he certainly made me one. What a true gentleman. His wife is terrific too. So is his son, Patrick Neve." Michael Ricks said, "Great interview, Pat. It brought back fond memories. So great to hear your voice." David Bunda said, "It was a great interview, as successful in life as he was on the stage. Common thread in these interviews, don't let Joe Weider get his hooks in you. Joe looked out for Joe." And I also heard from Pat Neve's son, Patrick Neve, and he thanked me for doing the interview with his dad, which was really, really nice. Also got some comments on my YouTube page. This was from the mayor of bodybuilding. This was our interview with Lee Labrada, which was our Skype interview. And the mayor of bodybuilding said, "This was the best and most in-depth interview ever. Lee Labrada was unreal at 190 pounds and a fantastic poser." Then I had a video up about when Frank Zane beat Arnold, which was excerpted from my interview with Jerry Branum. And Alan Greenson said, "Great channel content. I just listened to your interview with my friend Pat Neve. He's an amazing guy and a good friend. He helped me a lot with my lifting journey the last couple of years." Here's another comment from my YouTube page. This was from Jimmy J, and this was from the video, "Sergio Oliva Should Have Won the 72 Olympia," which is another short video I took from our Jerry Branum interview about the year 1968. And Jimmy says, "You Arnold fanboys are movie fans with zero knowledge of bodybuilding. Joe Weider picked every photo to back up his fake narrative that Arnold was better. Sergio Oliva's waist was a full 6 inches smaller than Arnold's. Sergio had a 28-inch waist, yet Sergio weighed an average 10 to 12 pounds more than Arnold in every Olympia competition, even though he was 3 inches shorter at 5'11". Sergio had bigger arms, legs, back, shoulders, and chest than Arnold. Sergio Oliva was completely ripped with a smaller waistline and bigger body parts, so why is Arnold better? Because Joe Weider gave him the title and made Arnold a household name. None of you fanboys knows anything about bodybuilding. Hollywood fanboys don't know shit about Mr. Olympia except who's on the magazines." All right. Very passionate email from Jimmy J. This one was about our interview with Boyer Coe, where we talked about the Nava Universe. Dave Cass said, I met Walter O'Malley a few times. He guest posed at a show in 2008 at 73 years old. The man is a beast. I love him. And Frank Richards are both great guys. I always enjoy when they came to Ireland. Wow, that's amazing. 73 years old and he was guest posing. All right, and before we get to our interview with Boyer Coe, I do want to mention that we're also brought to you by Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. Their certified and knowledgeable staff will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results you've been looking for. Their wide range of services will ensure that you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing that they're there for you every step of the way. Their competitive pricing, along with their quality products and services, are just a few reasons to give them a call. So call them at their office number, which is 813-922-8939, or you can reach them at their new website, flalternativemeds.com. And if you mention that you heard their ad on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, you will get a free consultation, and you'll also get 20% off your first order. And also be sure to mention their magic pill that they have, the new fat burner. All right, so that is it for our opening. Here is our interview from 2015, part one of our interview with Boyer Coe. You're really going to love this. Here we go. All right, welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legend Show. And my guest this week is a very special guest, someone I've just recently met, the very famous Boyer Coe. Boyer, you were, I think, a four-time Mr. Universe and a big contender in the Mr. Olympia for many years, so it's an honor to talk to you.
John, thank you for having me.
All right. Well, I know you've had a very extensive career, Boyer. I think you started all the way back in the 60s and competed up until the 90s, I believe, which was unusual for, I think, a lot of bodybuilders today. Most bodybuilders don't last that long. So I know you were born in Louisiana. Is that correct, Boyer?
That's correct, yes.
How did you get started in the sport of bodybuilding?
Well, it's kind of interesting. I was always interested in just being big and strong. The first time I recall seeing a bodybuilding publication, I was about 5 years old.
Wow.
And I was interested, I was drawn to the cover of the magazine because they had this big, powerful guy on the cover. Can't remember who it was at the time, but I couldn't read. And I didn't have any money in my pocket, it only cost 35 cents. So I swiped the magazine out of the grocery store, went home and read it. And I didn't really associate, you had to lift weights to do that. I just thought you got big and strong and then you lifted the weights. But I knew that's what I wanted to be like that. And I was always active as a kid. I was, I could run pretty fast and I was, could do, basic calisthenics and chins and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I guess about the time I was maybe 12 or 13, the first little gym opened up. It was called the Lake Charles Athletic Club. And I must have been one of the first 10 people to join up. And about that time, I really started buying the bodybuilding magazines. I mean, at that time, the only magazine that was widely available was Strength and Health, mm-hmm. Bob Hoffman's publications. So even though they only came out once a month, I must have been down at the newsstand once a week, hoping that I would see a new issue. Never had enough money to buy a subscription, but I would buy it certainly as a new issue, each issue came out. Mm-hmm. And so that's basically what I learned, or how to go about bodybuilding, because people just kind of lifted weights, but really wasn't anything. People had no idea what bodybuilding was about, or for that matter, the Mr. America contest. And then somewhere about the time I would say maybe 11 or 12 years old, Hercules came out with Steve Reeves.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
Oh my God. I remember watching that movie and I was so excited about seeing that movie and so inspired. I mean, the movie theater was downtown and it was a good 5 or 6 miles from my house. I didn't bother to ride the bus home. I ran home that night. I had, didn't have any weight, so the only thing I could think of to do was, well, I'm going to do push-ups. So I did push-ups all night long. I do push-ups, rest of the next morning, felt like someone had hit me in the chest with an axe. My chest was so sore. But I was really inspired, and I wanted to look like Steve Reeves. I mean, even today, I think if you would go back as far as bodybuilding has advanced, you'd see a photograph of Steve Reeves and the people that are currently in bodybuilding, people would still want to look more like Steve Reeves.
Yeah, it's interesting how many people were inspired by Steve Reeves and by that movie. I just did an interview with Samir Banute, Bill Grant, Mike Katz, and they all mentioned Steve Reeves and that Hercules movie.
Well, I, and because basically we're all about the same age, some a little bit younger, some a little bit older. But I think we grew up in, and it was just out of pure luck, the best time in bodybuilding. You know, I was thinking about that this morning before you called it. I mean, I felt so fortunate because I virtually knew everybody in the sport, the pioneers. I mean, I can think back how fortunate I was. Every photo session I ever did for Joe Weider, Weider was there at the photo session. It didn't matter if it was, you know, like John Bailick or Mike Nephew or Harry Langdon or Bob Gardner. All those photographs, photographers were there, but Joe was behind the scenes directing everything. And I think the guys today really missed out on that, not having Joe's inspiration there. And then also, I mean, I was personal friends with Vic Tanning, with Jack Lane. I was a close associate with Arthur Jones. Those guys were the real pioneers of the sport. And I got to know and work with those guys. I mean, if there's anything that I can say that I value the most in bodybuilding, more than any contest I ever won, was all the fantastic friends that I've made along the way.
That's the
most important thing.
Absolutely. So when you started Boyer, wasn't it Red Lyle who started to coach you and started to teach you how to train?
Well, an interesting story. The first guy that helped me out was a good friend of mine, Ken Gilbo. He was 7 years older than me.
And
this guy was a big guy. I mean, he was 6'2", about 225. And I watched him in the gym. I never talked to anybody in the gym. I was more like a sponge. I just sat and observed. And I realized that this guy kind of knew what he was doing. So I approached him, asked him if he would help me out with a routine. And he did. And I responded real fast. I mean, I really took to bodybuilding. So in about 1960, Red Lorel won the Mr. America contest.
And
I remember, I'm looking at Strength and Health magazine, and I see where a guy from Louisiana had won the Mr. America. So I told my dad, I said, "Hey, Dad, a guy from Louisiana won the Mr. America." I said, "You know what? I bet I can do that." He kind of laughed, and it was about the end of it. But a few months later, Red happened to be on his way going to Dallas to give an exhibition, and he happened to stop. He had a friend in Lake Charles where I lived, and he gave a posing exhibition at the YMCA. I don't know anything about it, but I happened to be watching, it was on a Friday night, watching the news, and it said the new Mr. America would give a posing exhibition, posing demonstration at the YMCA. So, man, immediately, I beat it down to the YMCA, and I watched him pose. That was the first time I'd ever seen a bodybuilder in person, and I knew for sure that's what I wanted to do. So a couple of years later, I guess that was when I was about 14. By the time I was 16, Ray Roy, who his brother was famed Alvin Roy, he had a gym in Lake Charles, and we were on our way to Baton Rouge to go to Alvin's place. And we stopped off in Lafayette, and that's where Red had just opened up his gym.
And that's
when I first officially met Red. And I told him, I said, "Look, as soon as I graduate from high school, I'm going to be back here. I want to train under you. I want to learn everything you know." That's how we became friends. And we've been best friends ever since, and he's been my mentor through my entire life. This guy really knows not only bodybuilding, but business. I mean, I would have to say he has the most, and I'm not coloring it anyway, he has the most successful health club in the world.
Wow.
I say that, let me give you a little description of it. It covers 20 acres of land. His parking lot will hold 3,000 cars. 8 It has over 20,000 members. 8,000 people a day work out there. He's got 250 employees. That gives you the scope of his club. His gym, his area, is over 300,000 square feet.
And this is
in Lafayette, Louisiana. And you got to remember, it's not that big of a town. It might be 150,000 people.
Uh-huh.
But because of the oil industry, it's an extremely progressive and rich town. And that's what's made his business so successful. And the fact that he's always, since he started in business, his place has been under constant construction or improvement. I mean, he didn't start out that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he started out with a very small business. Actually, he started out with $600 that he borrowed from his dad, made his own weights, and opened up the gym. And it's grown to this huge enterprise.
Amazing.
But he's the guy that originally inspired me. He's the guy that really taught me how to pose. You know, because he was a perfectionist. So when I trained every afternoon after I trained, we had a little rub down table in the back in a storage room there, and I practiced posing on that rub down table. So he definitely, I owe him a lot.
Wow. So this business is still going now, Boyer?
Oh, yeah, definitely. He's been in Lafayette. See, I went back for the 50th anniversary, so he's been in business now 52 years.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah, it's an incredible place to see. He's got everything. I mean, besides the gym and everything, he's got, I think, three or four Olympic-sized swimming pools. He's even got, he was the first place in the state of Louisiana to have indoor tennis courts.
Wow.
You know, you think of it, I mean, he's got a restaurant inside there, he's got a bar, he's got a Starbucks coffee, in it, whatever you want. Mm-hmm. I told him the only thing he's missing is if you had condominiums on site, people would never have to leave.
Right. So tell us a little bit about your training as a teenager, Boyer. I remember reading some stuff about you, and you were like a very, very strong teenager. I think you bench pressed, I can't remember how much weight in high school, and you had really big arms, and you, like you said, you responded to bodybuilding really fast.
I did respond very, very fast. I mean, I just really took to it. Yeah, one of the big things I had in high school, I was more, before I got really into bodybuilding, I was just being, I wanted to be strong.
Okay.
And at that time, to be able to bench press 400 pounds, that was kind of like a magic number. So I made up my mind, I wanted to bench press 400 pounds before I graduated from high school.
Wow.
That was my goal. So I guess, yeah, I mean, that would be nothing in the way of weights today, you know, but I managed to bench press 400 pounds before I graduated from high school, and I think I must have weighed about 179, 180 pounds at the time. So that was quite satisfying for me. As best I can remember back in those days, this goes back to 1964, there was only myself and another teenager, can't recall his name, but he lived in San Francisco. Never had an opportunity to meet him, but he was very strong in the bench press too. I've always wanted to hope that I could meet him one day and maybe we could have a contest, but never had to meet a guy.
Yeah, I remember reading something in, I think it was Muscle Builder magazine, and you were talking about visualization, and you said when you wanted to bench press that 400 pounds, you were writing down 400 all day long on a piece of paper, and you just thought about it all the time.
I got in trouble several times because I was in school, and I would sit, and when I didn't have a piece of paper, I would carve 400 into the desk. So several times people would pass it, what the hell are you doing marking up the desk here? I had 400 everywhere, you know.
Wow.
But
that's
motivating. And then you mentioned earlier about the big arms. My arms seem to always grow faster than anything else. I never did anything for special for arms. I remember reading an article, and it had an old picture, how Steve Reeves used to love to do incline curls.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, as a young bodybuilder, we always believe there's a secret. So I said, man, that's the secret to big arms. So I started doing incline curls. And that was the only thing I ever did for biceps, was
really?
Incline. And so I was so proud of myself one day because everybody always remarked, you know, you had that split in your bicep.
Yeah, yeah.
So I said, and no one thought, you know, I would literally live in the gym, so I could do that. And no one else could do it. So, man, I'm so proud of myself. So that night I get home, I said, hey, Dad, you know, I said, I can do something nobody else in the gym can do. He said, what's that? I said, well, look at my arm. I said, I can make it, my bicep split. So he said, yeah. I said, that's pretty good. And he and my daddy worked all day. He's tired. He's just trying to eat his dinner. He could probably care less about that. So after we finished dinner, he rolls up his sleeves. Let me see if I can do it. He could do it. He never lifted a weight in his life. But it was just genetic. So all of a sudden, my big ego was rapidly deflated. Here's another guy who could do the same thing. You know?
What does your dad do for a living, Blair?
Well, my dad was a sheet metal worker. He worked at the refineries there, and then he retired. And about that time, we opened up. We had health food stores. So we had three different health food stores, and he did that. He was always into fitness, but in his day, and he was an outstanding athlete, football player, and a boxer. But they discouraged people from, you know, from lifting weights. It says, you know, it'll make you muscle bound.
Right.
So
right.
Even though he encouraged me to lift weights, and he lifted some, but he was never able to get into it. You know, he was too worried about busy making a living for the family.
Right. I remember you credited your dad with not only showing you a good upbringing, but also just crediting you for being what a real man is all about.
Oh, most definitely. I mean, he was good enough in boxing that he could have probably turned professional. I've never seen anyone as fast as hand-eye coordination, as fast as him. But about that time, I came along, so you had to mm-hmm. had to band up and make a living for the family. You know?
Right. So when did you first compete then, Blair?
I tell you what, the first contest I went to, I was 15 years old. It was a Mr. All-South Teenage contest in Birmingham, Alabama. No experience. This was even before I met Red. No experience in posing. I just copied what I saw in Strength and Health magazines. Didn't even have a pair of posing trunks. I had a swimsuit, and I kind of rolled it up so it would be short. And I went to the contest, and I think I ended up maybe fifth. I remember Gable Boudreaux won, a guy from New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was... There was a guy, Billy Parker from Georgia. But it was a great experience for me because it was being a part of something. You know, I didn't expect to do anything. And I was so excited when I got on stage, I forgot the little posing routine I had made up. So I had to kind of ad-lib and get through it. But the bug really bit me. I knew that's what I wanted to do. Now, the second contest I entered was 2 years later. I went to the Mr. Louisiana contest. I had a week's notice.
Okay.
By that time, I had a pair of posing trunks. I knew it was going to do a little better. The interesting thing about that show, I was so nervous. And I mean, it was in January, and it was cold, and it was raining downtown YMCA in New Orleans. So, I'm so afraid I'm going to miss out on something. So we're back in the pump-up room, and I'm just pumping away. All of a sudden, I notice there's nobody left in the pump-up room. So I said, what the hell happened? So they called everybody out on stage, and I'm the last guy. So I'm so excited, I run out the wrong door. Well, the door I go out, slam shut, and I'm in the alley. So I'm outside in about 29-degree weather with nothing on but my posing trunks and baby oil. And I can't get back in because the door's locked.
Right.
So I went all the way down around the block, come in through the entrance, you know, through the crowd. Luckily, about the time I come through the crowd, they call my name, so I jump up on stage. Long story short, I ended up being third, and I won most muscular and a couple of body parts. So on the way home, my dad says, you know, says, that was pretty slick how you made that entrance. I never had the nerve to tell him that was just by accident. I was just trying to get into the contest. It was my stupidity running out the wrong door.
That's a great story. I remember reading that story a long time ago, and I don't know if you saw the movie Birdman with Michael Keaton, but something similar happened to him. He's doing a Broadway play, and he goes outside to get a smoke or something, and then he's got a robe on with just, I think, his... his underwear or something, because he had a bedroom scene that he's doing in the play, and the robe gets caught in the door, and he has to take it off and run outside and go around and go through the front of the theater and come up through the audience like you did. So I always remember that story.
I tell you, the interesting thing about that, my heart was beating so fast, because you want everything official contest, and here I am coming through the audience, my feet are filthy. I didn't even feel anything. I was numb. I was so excited. But I managed to get on stage and do whatever was necessary to at least complete my posing routine.
That's a great story. So didn't you win Mr. Louisiana when you were still a teenager?
I came out there. Yeah. So the next year, that was in January. In May, about 3 days before I graduated from high school, they had the Mr. New Orleans contest.
Okay.
Now, at the time, the Mr. New Orleans contest was a very famous contest. Actually, it's older than the Mr. America contest.
Wow.
Mr. America was started, I think, the AAU Mr. America.
Right.
Started in 1939. The first Mr. New Orleans contest was held in 1932.
Wow.
So it's a fairly long history. And they used to hold it outside at Pontchartrain Beach. So you would draw enormous crowds because it was the first night that they opened an amusement park.
Mm-hmm.
So the first contest I won was a Miss New Orleans contest, and that was probably the biggest crowd that I've ever faced, because there was at least 10,000 people in the audience because it was outside. It was quite something. I didn't appreciate it at the time because I was just trying to win a contest, but when I was thinking about it, I've never competed in a contest with that many spectators in the audience.
Right, right. And how old were you then, Blair?
I was 17.
17, wow. So where did you go from then? You went to the Teenage Mr. America also, didn't you, in 1965?
Actually, what happened after the Mr. New Orleans contest, they had a lot of local contests all throughout the South. Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, Florida. And one summer, and I think that was the summer, it was virtually a contest every weekend for, say, 12 weeks, 3 months.
Wow.
And
wow.
I did all of it. You know, I just loved going and being around and people, being part of it. Because you got to remember, in those days, nothing happened. The bodybuilding didn't even start till either the weightlifting or the powerlifting was done.
Right.
So I would enter the powerlifting contest rather than just wait around all day. And then usually around midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning, the bodybuilding contest would get underway. So that's what I did. But I was so in love with it, it didn't matter to me, you know?
Yeah.
And I guess the first national contest, I won a lot of those area contests. I think I won the Mr. Texas and Mr. Oklahoma, some of those contests. And then the first, I guess, national contest I went to was in 1966. I went to San Jose, California, and competed in the Junior Mr. America contest. And that was the first time I saw Sergio Oliva.
Wow.
He won the Junior Mr. America. And I've never been impressed with a bodybuilder like when the first time I saw him. It was unbelievable. I remember right before the prejudging, I was nervous. I went across the street to a Howard Johnson's just to get something to drink. Mm-hmm. And Sergio happened to be in there. And I never will forget that he's got a gold suit on with a white silk shirt and a purple tie. My God, he was just so impressed. And he's eating fried chicken and mashed potatoes. I'm so nervous, I can't even think about eating. This is getting ready for the prejudging. So, I mean, my eyes were just glued to him. And then backstage, we had waited around so long, we got to be friends. We got to be talking. And he and I were friends, you know, forever. But my God, his physique was unbelievable. I remember specifically that day, they measured his waist at 27 inches. And each of his thighs were 29 inches.
Wow, great.
The taper the guy had was just unbelievable.
And they did the measurements right there at the show.
Yeah, that was right there it was backstage at the contest.
Yeah.
I think he was first, God, I think he was first, Bob Guida was second, and I think John Carvello from around San Jose or San Francisco was third.
You're right.
Sergio was just unbelievable, you know. He got bigger later on, but his shoulder to back to waist difference was just unbelievable. I don't think it was ever more impressed me than the only other guy that's ever been. I mean, I always say, well, Sergio was a true genetic freak.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. And the only other guy that probably ever came close to that was Paul Bellette.
Yeah.
And he had that huge structure as well. And he was a bigger version of Sergio, but he really never had, he never could pose worth a damn. I don't know why he couldn't pose.
Right.
But
right.
Standing there, he was just unbelievable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned Sergio, because I grew up in Chicago, and when I was a teenager and I used to compete in teenage bodybuilding shows, Sergio used to come around. This was, I think, sort of after his peak. But I seen him guest pose a few times, and he was just so amazing to see in person. And I try to explain how great he looked back then. And you saw him even better. You saw him when he was really at his peak. So I'm glad you mentioned that, because people don't realize how great he was.
Oh, he was unbelievable. I remember the junior Mr. America. I'll always remember this. He was so good. He was so much better than everybody else in the contest. If he wouldn't have posed at all, if he would have just stood there, he would still won the contest with everybody else posing as hard as they could.
Right.
He was just incredible. And yet, he never really knew how to pose that well either.
Right.
He didn't see a lot of practice, but his physique was just so awesome. It's like you see it, and it's more than your eyes can actually take in. You can't believe what you're seeing.
Exactly. And then you went into the Mr. USA that year also, right, Boyer? And you took second to Dennis Santorino.
I continued to compete. I think it was in 66 or 67. But the guy, in other words, it's interesting how the AAU worked in those days.
Mm-hmm.
You sort of waited your turn.
Yeah.
Dennis Santorino, the first time I met Dennis, I knew of Dennis because I saw him in the magazines, but the first time Dennis and I met in person was at the 1965 Teenage Mr. America contest.
Okay.
And it was in Philadelphia. That was the first time I ever been on an airplane. So I went to Philadelphia, and Dennis was there, and they had tons of weightlifters. So the prejudging for the Teenage Miss America didn't even get started till 4 o'clock in the morning.
Oh my God!
Then we had to be back down there at 9 o'clock in the morning. That was the days you had to show proof of your athletic ability.
Right,
so you had to
right.
show all that stuff and the interviews. But Dennis won, and then the next year, Guider won the Miss America in '66. But the guys that came up all about the same time was me, Dennis, Jim Haslam, who was an outstanding physique.
Right.
Really, he was about the closest thing we had in our era to Steve Reeves.
Mm-hmm.
Blonde, handsome, nice-looking guy, tall, broad-shouldered. He won in, Dennis won in 67, 68. Now, I'd be honest, in 68, everything went wrong that could possibly be going wrong going through the Mr. America. I lost all my luggage. I didn't have anything. My pulling trunks, nothing. So about 15 minutes before the contest, I'm thinking, Jesus, maybe somebody will lend me a pair of pulling trunks. So as luck would have it, a cab showed up. They got my luggage. I mean, I just had enough time to get my stuff and get over to the contest.
Okay.
So
okay.
I thought I was in really good shape. And the funny thing about Jim Haslam, he was good in every contest we competed in the South. He would win, I was second. He must have did that about six times.
Uh-huh.
I was thinking, God, man, I know I can beat this guy. I think I'm as good as him. So I got a big response at the Mr. America contest. So then he started announcing the best body parts. I won all the body parts, I think, except best abdominals. Never had good abdominals. And I win the most muscular. Well, Jim didn't win any body parts. And you're in place in the top five in the most muscular. So I'm thinking backstage, man, I got to win this contest.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
He's 2-1.
Wow.
But then, and I thought I was, to be honest, I thought I was in better shape in 68, or at least as good a shape as I was in 69. But it was his turn. So then in 69, I guess they decided, well, we'll let Burley win. you know. But so I won in 69. And then that same year, an interesting story about the NABBA universe. See, and back in those days, even though they had started the Mr. Olympia, the NABBA universe was a contest that had all the history.
Right.
And you really wanted to win that NABBA universe. That was of all the contests and everything I've done, that was the one I appreciated the most, was winning that NABBA universe the first time. So we go over there, and Haislip is there because he had lost the year before to Dennis Tenorino.
Okay.
So I'm saying, well, God, it's got to be, maybe it's going to be my turn. Once again, bad luck. The night before I'm going to leave, my workout partner and I are training in the gym, and we used to use rosin on our hands, you know, to get a better grip on the bench press. He didn't really put a good enough hand, so it falls in my eye. So I can't get the stuff out of my eye. So by the time I get to New York, my eye is swollen shut. I can't see. Man. So then you got an all-night flight to London. By the time I get to London, I'm really bad. It's horrible. So I said, okay, I don't know what to do. So I go to the hospital in London. The guy manages to clean the eye out, gives me a patch. So I look like a pirate. I'm walking around the hotel, and everybody asks me, is that the Mr. America? You only got one eye. So by the next morning, I took the patch off. My eye was okay. So luck would have it, I was fortunate enough to win the Miss Universe. I finally bested Jim Haslam. But he was a guy who could have went on and had a fantastic career.
Yeah.
Because he had the look. He had the look of a champion. But he just retired after that, you know. Well, he lives down there in Florida.
He lives right here in Tampa, yeah. I met him once before, yeah.
Very, very nice guy. Wonderful guy. Dennis was a great guy as well.
Yeah, I never got a chance to meet Dennis. I'm really sorry about that. I wish I could have met him before he passed away.
Yeah, he was lots and lots of fun.
Yeah.
I mean, when we competed in those days, it was a lot more camaraderie. I mean, I can remember when he won the Junior Mr. America contest. It wasn't like it is today. Everybody's got sponsorships. Hell, we paid on our own way.
Yeah.
I can remember at one Junior Mr. America, I think the year Dennis won, we only had enough money for one hotel room. So Dennis, Chris Dickerson, and myself and somebody else all stayed in the same room. but we were just friendly competitors. You know, it wasn't all animosity you see in competitors today.
Yeah, I just interviewed Chris a couple days ago, and that's what he said. He said after the shows, everybody would go out to eat together. Exactly. And they'd say, like, you know, oh, you won this time, I'll get you next time, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I guess things have changed a lot. I mean, to be honest with you, I don't know. I heard Lee Labrada say this one time, and I think it's true. Either I've gotten to a point now where maybe I've outgrown bodybuilding, or bodybuilding's outgrown me. But I don't have any interest in seeing the contest anymore. It's totally different. And I'm happy that the guys are making a lot of money. I mean, we did everything they did, except we did it for free. It's a good thing, you know.
Now, what was your training and diet like back then, Boyer, back in the 60s? Were you guys training like 6 days a week and dieting low carbs?
I trained 6 days a week. I mean, there's only a couple of times that I varied, you know, my routine. Naturally, when Arthur Jones came out with the high-intensity training, I never liked that. I couldn't get into it because I like to focus on the exercise I'm doing. Even though I trained heavy, I wasn't in a rush to get through that, you know. And while I think Arthur was onto something, and it was perhaps good at training, like say a football team, I think that was it. But it wasn't really good for bodybuilding. And I tried that, and I must say I had success with that type of training, but on a different variation of that. It was skipping quite ahead in 1994. I trained like that, but I trained 2 days on, 1 day off.
Okay.
Something like that. And I would do, and basically I got that kind of developed that routine. It evolved from being friends with Dory and Yates, and And where we do a couple of warm-ups, and then our first all-out set would be one set. But we might do a couple of warm-up sets to make sure we were warmed up and do as heavy as possible and go to failure. And then even after that, we would do some negatives.
Okay.
But other than that, I basically always train 5 or 6 days a week.
So talk a little bit about when you won the Mr. America. How did that feel, winning that in 1969? I know you beat out like Chris Dickerson and Ken Waller was there. How did that... How did you feel that competition went?
Well, it was kind of anticlimactic because I knew I had won the Junior Mr. America maybe a month before that. So going into the Mr. America, I felt, well, this was probably going to be my year. But I really, and I remember discussing this with Mike Mentzer at length one time. We were talking about, well, how did it feel when you won the Mr. America? And Mike said, well, man, he says, I felt great because it was an accomplishment that I had been after for a long time. He said, well, what was your reaction? I said, I never took time to enjoy it. I can well remember, because it was in Chicago. I won the Miss America in Chicago.
Okay.
And I remember, you know, sitting in the dressing room after it was all over with. I mean, this was maybe 10 minutes after the contest, and I'm thinking, okay, now, well, I won this. Now, what the hell I got to do to try and win the Miss Universe? I was already focusing on the next thing.
Yeah.
So I never took time to appreciate what I had accomplished. It was on to the next thing.
Yeah, I think that's typical of most competitors, though. We're so hard on ourselves, and we're always saying we never really enjoy the victory. We're always thinking about, you know, winning that one, then you got to win the next one, and you never really get to enjoy it.
Yeah, it was. I always use bodybuilding competitions is kind of like a measuring stick of my progression.
Mm-hmm.
To be honest with you, I never had a whole lot of respect for the judges. Because most of those guys, particularly in the days of the AAU, God, those guys acted most of the time like they didn't even want to be there. And they talk really down to bodybuilding. And I always remember an incident that happened in 1968. I remember this is kind of about the height of the Vietnam War. And Jim Haseth won. We're at the prejudging meeting. And this AAU guy, Rudy Sablo, he's just ordering everybody else around, talking to us like we're a bunch of cattle. And one of the competitors, Dr. Craig Whitehead, who was a captain in the Air Force, I mean, he sat there and he listened to Rudy order us around. And he finally stood up and he says, you know, I don't have to take this shit. He says, I'm done with this. He was dressed in his captain's uniform and he walked out. And I really admired him for that. But being young and not being very experienced, I just sat there. I didn't say anything. Mm-hmm. But I always remember that. I mean, and I appreciated what he did because he stood up for what he believed in. Even though he wanted to compete in the Mr. America, he wasn't going to be treated like a dog.
Right.
And I really admired the guy for that. And that was it. He never came back and never competed again.
Hmm. What was your experience like with the NABBA Universe, competing in the NABBA Universe that year in 69?
That was my most fulfilling, satisfying moment because Oscar Heidenstein, even though there was no money, we didn't have a nice hotel to stay in. You didn't have a bathroom in a hotel. There was one bathroom on each floor.
Wow.
So, but he treated everybody with such respect. I mean, he had the great love for bodybuilding.
Mm-hmm.
And you could tell just by the way he put his heart and soul into it. And then you got to remember, this was a contest that John Brimmick won, that Reg Park won, that Bill Pearl won, that Steve Reeves won. So naturally, you wanted to be part of that history.
Right, right. And then you got to meet guys like Arnold Schwarzenegger and Franco Colombo, Frank Zane. Was that the year you got to meet a lot of those guys?
Well, I'd actually met Arnold earlier that year. Arnold came to Chicago to visit Sergio, and they went to the Mr. America the year I won. So
that's right. Okay.
I knew of Arnold. I'd seen his pictures in the magazine, but I met him in person then. And then about a month later, I flew out to California, and Cliff Swan was a photographer, and he photographed me for Strength and Health. And I think at that time, I met Franco at that time. He had only been in the country one day. Couldn't speak any English at all.
Okay.
But
okay.
I met him and Arnold coming to pick me up at the airport. And people get confused a lot because I was never really a West Coast guy.
Mm-hmm.
I was good friends with Joe Gold, did a lot of business with Joe Gold over the years, really admired the guy a lot. But I never really trained at Gold's. Because I always was living back in Louisiana at the time. I didn't move out to California until 79. So by that time, Joe had Worlds, and he wasn't even a part of Gold's anymore at that time.
What did you think of Arnold when you first met him at that Mr. America contest in 69?
Well, he was big. I mean, what always his advantage was his height, you know. He wasn't near as arrogant as he is now, but he seemed to be a nice enough guy.
Okay. How about Frank Zane? When did you first meet Frank?
Well, I met Frank well before I ever met Arnold. When I was competing in the local contest, I competed in a contest down in God, I can't remember where it was at, but it was right outside of Tampa, Florida. Once again, Jim Haysup and I were in the contest,
mm-hmm.
and Frank was living in Tampa at the time. He lived in an apartment house right across the street from Harry Smith's gym.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, and I was also the very first, so this would have had to have been, I guess, back in 1967, maybe, and that I wasn't all in that great a shape, and the only reason I went to compete in the contest, I had never seen Bill Pearl in person, and he was a guest poser. So I wanted to see Bill Pearl. That's the first time I met Bill Pearl, and once again, we've been lifelong friends ever since then. That, to me, is a real important thing that bodybuilding has given me the privilege of meeting all these wonderful people and being friends with them.
Yeah, now I was going to ask you about Bill Pearl. I know you've had a long friendship with him. Tell us a little bit about meeting him and your feelings about Bill.
You can't say enough nice things about Bill Pearl.
Yeah.
He's one of the humblest guys you will ever meet. He's very giving, and he'll give you a straight opinion about something. You know, and he'll tell you flat out, but what a wonderful guy. And I tell you, one of the things that impressed me the most about Bill has an older brother, Harold. Harold actually had better genetics than Bill.
Wow, I heard about that.
Harold a couple of times. When Bill had his gym on Manchester Avenue there in Inglewood, back in California, I went by his gym. That was right after I won the Mr. America. And Harold was just as nice. He was actually big. Everybody talks about how big Bill Pearl was. Harold was even bigger than Bill. You know, so I mean, those guys had some unbelievable genetics, and I think he's a couple of years older than Bill.
What did you think of Bill when you first saw him guest pose, Boyer? Because we just talked about Sergio, people don't remember how great Sergio was, but Bill Pearl was another one. He was so overpowering on stage and a great poser.
Well, you're right. I mean, Sergio, because of his freakish development and proportion, was unbelievable, but Pearl was like a consummate professional. I mean, the first time I saw him pose, he posed, and it was just unbelievable because he was so big and so powerful, and he knew how to hit poses that really made his physique look even more Herculean. And then he also, one of the things I learned long ago was the transitions. What you do when you move from pose to pose.
Right, right.
You know, and he was the master at that. And then he came out a second time, and he used to do an old strongman or Sandow, Eugene Sandow thing. He had like a fur posing suit,
right,
and the sandals,
right,
and all that stuff. He did that. And then he also did some strongman stuff, like he tore license plates in half and bend spikes and stuff like that. So that was all part of his professional show, and it was just incredible. But his physique, the best way I can describe it, he's a man without any effort at all demands dignity. I mean, you just automatically respect this guy graciously when you see the guy. He's that kind of guy.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
just all he has about it.
I agree with you 100%. I met Bill myself when I was like 25 years old. They had a big the club industry show in Chicago, you know, the trade show for the fitness.
Oh, yeah.
And when Bill was working for Life Fitness, I remember I was a 25-year-old kid, and I was walking through the expo, and I saw him, and I was wondering if I should go over and meet Bill Pearl. And he came up to me, shook my hand, and said, you know, you got a kind of physique that we had in back in my day. And I was just so blown away that he came up to me and complimented me before I could even approach him.
Well, he is one of the most nicest, sincere individuals on planet Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy looks incredible for his age.
I know.
He's unbelievable.
Yeah, God bless him. He lives a long life.
His mind is as sharp as a tack. I mean, he sees you one time. He might see you 20 years from now. He's still going to remember John Hanson. Hey, how are you?
Right? I know.
He's the best I've ever met about remembering names.
Right. That's amazing. So continuing on with your career, Boyer, you went back to the Mr. Universe in 1970, and you went into the pro division at the NABBA Universe, and you won the short class, and Arnold, of course, won the overall there.
Yeah. Well, on the way over there, I caught the flu. So, that was a miserable time. But I managed to get through the contest. Interesting thing about the 1970, we had the contest on a Saturday night, the NABBA Universe. The next night, Sunday night, we flew all the way from London to Columbus, Ohio, and competed in the Mr. World contest.
Right, right.
That was some kind of trip. It was me, Arnold,
Dave Draper,
and Dave Draper.
Right.
Yeah, another fantastic guy.
Yeah. And so Jim Lorimer arranged a flight for you guys so you guys could get to the contest on time and compete.
Well, what happened, our flight was delayed in London. We were several hours late. So I still to this day don't know how he managed to pull the strings. But when we landed in New York, we were ushered off the plane. I don't ever remember going through customs. We just immediately ushered off the plane, went out a side door. A car took us over to a private jet, and it seems like within 20 minutes, as soon as they got our baggage, we were on our way to Columbus. And when we got to Columbus, everything else was already over with. The weightlifting was over with. Even the amateur world, was already over with. So when we finally get to the auditorium, I don't know how long the crowd had been sitting there, but it must have been sitting there for some amount of time, and then we had the contest that night.
Yeah, everybody talks about it.
They were just sitting there waiting for us to get there to have the contest. Well,
everybody talks about that contest as that was the show where Arnold first beat Sergio, but you know, you were also in that show. What did you think about Arnold beating Sergio at that show?
Well, Arnold was better. He was coming off of a win.
Right.
I don't think Sergio was fully prepared for that show. But then, you know, what, 2 weeks later in the Olympia, Sergio looked, it might have been 3 weeks, but it wasn't very long. But Sergio looked unbelievable at the Olympia.
Mm-hmm. And then Arnold beat him again.
Right.
Yeah. So then we go into... Now, you never went over to the IFBB right away, right? You stayed with the... I'm sorry. You went into the IFBB in 71. You won the Mr. America there.
Well, no, I didn't. This is what happened. Eddie Silvestri used to hold the Mr. International contest in Tijuana.
Right.
And I would give these unbelievable trophies. I remember when I won the Mr. International, the trophy was so big. It must have weighed 120 pounds.
Really?
It was marble and bronze. So when I get back, I said, when we get back from Tijuana, I said, I can't carry this thing on the plane. So we had to disassemble it, pack it in a box, and ship it home on a Greyhound bus. So while I'm out here, they said, well, you know, next weekend is Wheeler's IFBB Mr. America. I said, well, I'm here. I might as well enter. Well, Ken Waller won that contest.
Okay.
So Ken Waller won a contest. Then, the next weekend, Dan Lurie used to hold his WBBG Professional Mr. World contest. So we went in that contest. I was fortunate enough to win. And then I didn't enter the IFBB, Mr. Olympia. I didn't go into that because I was satisfied with just competing in the NAVA universe. I went back several times in that. But Arnold called me in 76 and he said, you know, I'm putting on the Olympia in Columbus. Will you compete in it? And I had met Jim Lorimer several years earlier. See, when Dennis won the Mr. America in 67, Lorimer organized that contest. That's when I first met him and became friends with him. So I knew Jim was part of that. So I said, yeah, I'll compete in it. So I didn't go to the NAVA. I decided, okay, I'll compete in the Mr. America. So I went to Columbus, and Ben Weider says, oh, you're a NAVA guy. You can't compete in the Mr. America.
Hmm.
I said, man, I'm already here. I said, Arnold invited me. So I will say this. I mean, Arnold stood up to me. He said, look, he said, I invited Barry to compete in a contest. He's got to compete. I was ready to compete in the contest. So Ben Weider relented, and that was how I got into Mr. Olympia the first time.
How many times did you win the NAVA Universe then, Blair?
I won the NAVA Universe, three times. I won in 69, in 73, and 75.
Okay.
And then I stopped going after that, and after that I just competed in IFBB contests. By that time, the Mr. Olympia and IFBB was growing a lot stronger.
Right.
And you got to remember, I never forget one guy who doesn't get much credit, and that's Wayne D'Amelio. Had it not been for Wayne D'Amelio, professional bodybuilding would have never, ever developed into what it was today.
Hmm.
He was a catalyst behind all of that. He was the one that started all the Grand Prix in Europe. He was the one that created the Night of Champions. And that by far, the Night of Champions was much more exciting than even the Mr. Olympia.
Hmm.
I don't know if it was because all the acts that he and Charlie Blake created, or if it was just the crowd in New York, but I tell you, those people would go nuts. I remember that was quite an exciting time.
Wow.
Yeah, he deserves a lot of credit. And then one thing with IFBB, they started with the sanction fees, and they raised them so high, nobody could afford to put the contest on anymore. So that's when Wayne got involved and said, okay, we're going to put the contest on. And he made it very, very successful. In other words, his venues for the Mr. Olympia was best. I mean, they used to hold it at the Mandalay Bay, which is far superior to where they hold it today.
Right. Yeah, people may not remember that, but you're right. Back then, there was only the Mr. Olympia. That was professional bodybuilding until Wayne came along, and then he started creating, I think he started, what was it, first, 78, I think was the first one, right, where he started creating the Night of the Champions, right, and then all the Grand Prix events.
I never will forget. I was, after, I guess, Ben Weider decided I was a good guy, he invited me as a guest poser. In those days, that was before they held the World Championships, it was the Mr. IFBB Mr. Universe.
Right.
So it was held in Montreal.
Right, I remember that.
Go to Montreal and guest pose, and I had no idea who Wayne D'Amelio was. He comes up to me. He's a guy that's got like about a 3-day growth, kind of not dressed in anything important. He says, would you be willing to compete in a contest? He said, if I paid all your expenses, and he said, the prize money would be $5,000. I said, sure, I'll do it. I never thought of more about it. So maybe 6-8 months go by, I get a contract in the mail from Wayne, and that's how we became friends. And he really worked, and he did a lot. And in those days, see, people don't remember, but in those days, not only did you compete in the contest, but you had to go out and help sell the tickets. I remember we'd go, like when they held the Grand Prix in Miami, we went into Miami a week earlier. We hit every possible gym in the Miami area trying to sell tickets.
Really?
So you go and promote the tickets all day long and hope people would show up so you could see you compete in the contest. Today, all you got to do, you got to show up. I'd like for them to think, hey, maybe we contributed to all the benefits that you're having today. Even in those days, they had no food allowance. You showed up at the contest, maybe they paid your hotel bill. That was about it. So we finally said, okay, well, then how about covering our food expenses and some hotel, and, you know, and he agreed to it. And that's how all of that got started.
All right, thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I want to thank our sponsors, Florida Alternative Medicine and Old School Labs, for sponsoring this episode. And now, as promised, I am going to read from the February 1977 issue of Muscle Builder and Power magazine. This article is called The Charisma of Bodybuilding. It's written by Jack Neary. Here we go. Jack says, "We hadn't been airborne for 5 minutes, and already the wisecracks were rolling off that loquacious tongue through a Pride of Deutschland accent into the ears of at least a dozen bewildered passengers. Hey, Robbie, your lats are sticking out too far into the aisle. The stewardess can't get by. The triceps, Robbie. There are some veins hanging down." Several rows up, Robin Robinson, sheathed in a t-shirt as tightly clad to his torso as a label on a champagne bottle, noticeably shrunk in his seat and covered his mouth in an effort to stifle convulsive burst of embarrassed laughter. Arnold Schwarzenegger is in prime element this day. His perceptive mix of the silly with sober moves surrounding seatmates from gape to giggle. It is a spirit de buffoonery at 33,000 feet. Wedged between the Austrian wonderkind and an old lady who feels sorry for senior citizens because they lose a piece of the action, your reporter copiously fills his notebook with the bon mot that comes acking from this Bavarian mouth. The notes are vital. Your reporter hopes they will play a big part in his latest challenge to discover and explore the charisma of bodybuilding. He had met the challenge 2 weeks before this flight, then backed off, not so much from a fear of the assignment, but more out of respect for it. The plan of attack was unclear. The formulation was vague. It would be a tough cookie to write. En route to Vancouver, Canada, to observe Schwarzenegger and Robinson guest pose at the Mr. North America contest, your reporter is anxious the excursion will reveal the answer to this charisma challenge. It'll be the first time he has seen these men display their bodies on stage. There is a certain aspect of being caught up in it. The success of this story depends on the ability to assume a position apart from the meat of the plot, to capture the image in toto. Arnold will have none of this masquerade. Champagne is ordered. We must be drunk for these guys when we land. There's no telling what one can run into on these trips. This fall I have an exhibition every weekend. I made sure September was free so I could spend some time at home. By the time the aircraft is touched down in Vancouver, Arnold has officially dubbed the stewardess Miss Airplane 1976 for the shape of her legs, engaged in a tete-a-tete about steroids with a professor of metabolism, and expressed a desire to eat again. There will be no meal for a while. Lounging under gazebos with juleps in hand and notebooks in the other, a gaggle of jaded reporters and photographers wait poolside at a nearby airport hotel for the arrival of Arnold. He has been publicized greatly for this event. His alluring gap-toothed grin has beamed down from posters plastered about the city, a picturesque bayside burg of over 1 million people. Yes, there is no hiding the fact that these dozens or so media minions are here because of Arnold, and not for petty trivia on what they firmly are convinced is simply a male beauty contest. Oh, for sweet ignorance. Standing about the outer fringe of the press gathering are a few of what one promoter of the contest calls muscle heads. They are appropriately adorned in respective gym t-shirts, chatting impatiently about so-and-so's triceps. They, too, have made the pilgrimage here, not for small talk about a contest that they've been awaiting for 3 months, but for the man who is just now walking beneath spruce boughs in the courtyard headed toward the pool. Heads turn. The reporters remain stone-faced, but one photographer mumbles, "Good Christ," as the motor drive of his Nikon begins whirring with piston regularity. Arnold directs a couple of the muscle heads to put the tables together and gather up some chairs so we can get this show rolling. They seem honored. Arnold grabbed a chair and parked his frame. Like professional voyeurs, the reporters sat and eyed the expanse of his arms. They didn't quite know what to make of this. They didn't quite know where to start. "Don't worry, I'm not going to take off my shirt." One writer becoming blue-face with strain allows his ample avoirdupois to spill over into his belt in a relaxed state. Arnold turns to his right and looks at a woman, the quintessence of Germain gear, complete with beaten sandals, burlap handbag, denim midi, and prematurely gray hair. Who do you write for? Kinesis. It's a feminist magazine. With raised eyebrow, Arnold gives her the once-over. The other reporters laugh, and we're off. A middle-aged writer who resembles Allen Ginsberg and talks like David Frost offers, "Do you sleep on your back?" "No, but I'd sleep on my head for variety's sake." They've been hooked. The charm is unfurling out of Arnold. I asked the question in reference to Carol Doda. She always had to sleep on her back because in any other position she might have hurt something. Your chest is decidedly larger than hers. I don't think about what happens for me when the time I fall asleep to the time I wake up. Whatever happens, happens. Laughter all around. Robbie Robinson, who is sitting beside your reporter, appears bored with the entire proceedings and later confides, "Man, I hate these interviews. I was sitting there nodding off. Arnold can do the talking. I'm starved." Arnold meets each question with my little tape recording. People don't realize that everyone bodybuilds. If you're trying to lose a few inches off your waistline or maybe tone your thighs, you are bodybuilding. But there's another form of bodybuilder, and that is the competitive one. Of all the bodybuilding people, only 5% compete in physique contests. Conversation stumbles onto money. More than one reporter seems keenly intent on determining how much this 6'2" bone mangler with the 57-inch chest earned per annum. I don't talk about how much money I make. It is not important. I have found that America only respects those who make a lot of money. "Do you feel you get as much attention from women as Miss America gets from men?" queried Miss Lib. "I get more attention than Miss America does. If she walked down the street, you couldn't pick her out from a lot of other beautiful girls. Not so with me." "When you're at a beach and women see your body, do you think they enjoy that?" "I get propositions from women and men on the beach. Some of them get turned on by a well-built man." "Is it true that some people just can't build muscle? I mean, we all can't be like you." "Bodybuilding's a mental thing. You shouldn't set limits on yourself. A case in point. Nobody said 500 pounds could be clean and jerked. Then a Russian comes along and does it, and in 1 month, five others did it." By the close of the conference, Arnold has put those writers into his palm, shaken them like dice, and thrown the magic seven right into his corner. They left that interview thinking Arnold was an okay guy after all. He is, of course, the goodwill ambassador of bodybuilding. He has proven it. An hour later, Arnold is trundling about the city with the promoter of the next night's contest on a whirlwind tour of the radio stations. Your reporter would join him later on Open Line Talk Show, but now is sitting in a quaint restaurant in Gastown, the city's answer to Greenwich Village, with Robinson talking about the charisma of bodybuilding. "If you want to know what the charisma of bodybuilding is, it's Arnold," says Robbie, busy savaging a tuna salad. "Yeah, he's the man. Bodybuilding is what it is today because of Arnold and the IFBB. I don't know what it is about him, but people just fly at him like a magnet. He has that charismatic personality. When I first came onto the scene and people started to hear about me, I was very shy. I still am very introverted. I really need my privacy. And crowds and interviews, things like that, really bothered me. But now I'm starting to come out of my shell. I'm going to have to open up to the people if I want to get where Arnold is. I mean, it's the people who make you. Without them, you're nothing." It's getting late, and a Meet Arnold reception is scheduled for later that evening. On the way back to the hotel, we stop at a camera shop to pick up a 16mm projector for the Mr. Olympia and Universe films to be screened at the reception. After buying Dan Near a gunny sack of fruit, Robbie steps into the shop in all his sassy splendor. "This is the man I was talking about," comments our driver. Robbie nods. A short, pixie-like Chinese girl completely abandoned the customer she was helping and ignited. "Oh, wow! Would you look at those muscles? Can you believe it? Mr. Universe here in our shop! Oh, Fabiola! I must have a picture!" She disappeared into an adjacent storage room. There was no hiding Robbie's embarrassment. Man, this is a trip. For a person who worked in a camera store, what she brought out to shoot pictures with seemed a paradox. A battered Instamatic with masking tape circumventing the housing would do the trick, she assured us. No one really cared. Grabbing Robbie by the wrist, she pulled outside toward a parked step van upon which was painted Johnson's Toasted Nuts. "Oh, Fabiola, what a perfect background. I'll stand in front of you while you show your muscles, and I'll get someone to take the shot." The girl had her back to Robbie, and of course she couldn't see the pose he hit. We were all thankful for that. Who knows what she would have done had she seen that double bicep shot. Such peaks. Robbie is the only man capable of matching Arnold's unique ability of making his muscles jump out at you. Some bring them to a slow flex, others will hit a pose fast, but the rise in muscle is negligible. But when Robbie swung those arms up in a graceful arc with those peaks almost taking off through the skin, you knew you were seeing something special. Arnold and your reporter are sitting in the palatial radio studio of CKNW's Art Finley, a very witty, articulate, and sometimes acerbic talk show host who creates the funniest cartoons, Art's Gallery, for the San Francisco Chronicle. We admire the view. Yeah, you might say this view is the cat's ass. Arnold obliges the request for a Polaroid of he and Finley. I look like a pimple that fell off you, but I always like to get pics of my guest. A red light goes on. Finley flips a switch on his Star Trek console and is on the air. Hello again, it's Art Finley with you, and sitting before me today is the most incredible looking man anyone would care to imagine. He has got muscles, and I mean he's got so many muscles, the sidewalk cracks when he spits. During a commercial break, Finley said Arnold probably had muscles in his shit. He is Arnold Schwarzenegger, and I'm sure I pronounced that correctly. Arnold pipes up. You are the first interviewer to go on the air without asking me how to say my name and get it right. Schwarzenegger. A name that is hard to say is a name easy to remember. There is the standard dissertation on Arnold's accomplishments. The biography is short. Talk falls onto the standard avenues of bodybuilding discussion. Charles Atlas is called Charles Fatless by Finley. Tell me, who supplies your clothes? A tent and awning company? No, I have a tailor custom make any suits I might need or dress shirts. I give him a picture of me, sign it, tell him he's the greatest tailor in the world, and I get it half price. He gums a smoldering cigar, and instantly Arnold takes up with a plastic coffee stir stick, screwing his eyes up as great billows of blue smoke come drifting silently over his microphone. Those kind of hard to light, says Finley. Yeah, but this is pretty good stuff. The switchboard begins to light up. The calls are pouring in. A woman comes on. Her voice is hard and gruff with cigarettes and booze, or so it seems. Hello, Art. I think Arnold is just gorgeous. I've seen him on TV. He is so cute. Is he there? Can I talk to him? Sure, he's all yours. Arnold, this lady likes you. Hi, Arnold. How are you? I'm just terrific. How are you? Oh, I think I'm in love with you. You're the most fantastic. Do you have a crush on me? I sure do. Then you better give me a kiss. Right now, over the airwaves. A sharp report of static comes over the monitor. A sloppy kiss. Marconi would have been proud. Oh, that's a good one. Very delicious. Back at the hotel, about 50 muscleheads await Arnold. They patiently nibble on hors d'oeuvres, but Arnold insists on dinner first. The promoter is miffed, but guess who's not worried? The promoter's wife asked if he would ever stop lifting. If I didn't work out, I think I'd be a criminal. I can never imagine not lifting weights. Right now, I do it for myself. I'm having more fun in the gym now than ever before. Holding court from the end of the table, a filet mignon on a silver platter before him, Arnold tells one of his favorite stories. It was the 1974 Olympia in New York. I had just beaten Franco, and I remember we were all standing around. Everybody was happy, and we were trying to find a party to go to. Well, this guy comes over to me, and he's got makeup all over his face, and rings, and bracelets, and perfume coming off him like a French whore. This guy says with sort of a lisp, "Oh, Arnold, please flex your biceps for me. I've come all this way to see it up close." So I give him a bicep shot, and then he reaches up and plants a kiss on my arm. And then he ran off. Well, we went out to this party, and when I came back to the hotel, I looked in my room's mail slot, and there was this envelope for me. So I opened it up, and a note was in it from the fag who kissed my bicep. He said something about how he could feel every one of my 22 inches on his lips, and how it was the most exciting thing he's ever done, and how money was no object to him. Because with this note was a money order for $1,000, just for kissing my biceps. Well, I go up to my room and I tell Franco, and he starts to get all excited and says, "If you're worth $1,000, then I'm worth at least $500. Give me his address." I tell him there is no address with the note, and Franco screams, "Yeah, you just don't want me to have the money." Arnold builds the punchline with a great deal of bravado and revels gleefully in the laughter he has wrought. With prompting from the promoter, Arnold and the entourage are shuttled off to the reception room where the projector is just starting to flicker images of the Last Universe contest on the screen. and a raucous cheer goes up from the gathering when a close-up of Robbie's face is shown. There's a break in the film, and Arnold's Austrian voice cuts through the dark. This is a commercial break. Buy Wieters, crash weight gain, builds muscles fast. Uproarious laughter. It is the next day, and after the afternoon spent on top of a nearby mountain doing Nikon imitations, 800-pound squats with but a slender branch from a tree, complete with grotesque facial transmorphification, and telling the queen of cellulite her underpants were hanging out, Arnold is backstage at the theater, genuinely marveling at the condition of some of the contestants who are just now pumping up. It is a sellout. Over 2,500 people are here, and it's Arnold that put them in those seats. When we entered the lobby of the sumptuous theater, Arnold asked an usherette if he could quickly look at a program she was holding. He flipped through a few pages and then came upon a page with a photograph of himself and Robbie. He pointed to the picture of himself and asked, "Is this man here yet?" "No, I don't think so. I think this black guy came through, but I haven't seen this Arnold." Arnold smiled and started to walk off. Your reporter asked the usherette to take a closer look at the real-life Arnold, and then it hit her. It was not unlike some of the finer moments of Candid Camera. We are in the official pumping-up room. It is the size of a basketball court and has acoustic tiling all around. Chest high, attached to the wall, are dancers' bars, the ones used for stretching legs. Like a field general, Arnold patrols the perimeter of the room, saying little, just watching. A nervous tension seems to build amongst those pumping up. Robbie sits on a wobbly table near the door and shakes his head and says, "Man, look at these guys. They're pumping up too much. There's no need to pump up like this. They're having a workout. I only need one set, just to get the blood flushed in there. They really show their inexperience." Arnold is considerably less concerned about the entire thing. "As long as I get my $1,500, I don't care if they introduce me as Arnold Schwarzenhemmenglunken." A man sticks his head into the room and yells, "45 seconds and the first man is on." A frazzle-haired, lithe black kid chirps, "That's me. Hey, that's me. What do you mean 45 seconds? I'm not ready. I need oil." He grabs a bottle of Johnson's baby oil and liberally pours it all over his body. He looks like a glazed donut. "Hey man, I need a towel. Someone have a towel? Somebody's got to have a towel. Anything. Dirty underwear. But I need a rag, man." He's thrown a t-shirt and runs from the room. Robbie shakes his head. "I remember one time I was in Quebec somewhere for a guest exhibition," Arnold says to a reporter from the Toronto Globe and Mail, "and they called me up, and I came out from the crowd to the stage with my street clothes on, and then I took them off right there. I had my posing trunks on underneath." Winston Roberts is here. He is the IFBB's general secretary. "Titles," he mentions, "are very important in the IFBB. You should give yourself one." Winston helped judge the contest this morning and is now heading out to grab a seat for the show. Arnold says the running joke about Winston is that he never takes off his official IFBB jacket, even when he goes to bed. After a spindly youth adorned in Leviathan-sized boxer trunks goes through his Mr. Anemic World routine, Arnold and Robbie head on to the changing room to prepare for their bits. Robbie will precede Arnold. He quickly dons a pair of pale green trunks. He asks a kid standing near to help him with the oil. The kid later said, "I started to rub some oil onto his back, working it out into the lats, and I kept going and going. I thought I'd never reach the end." Robbie won't be needing a pump tonight for the rest of his life. He's in better shape than Arnold. It's obvious. Robbie knows it. Arnold knows it. Who cares? Robbie had said earlier in the day that he would hit only 6 or 7 poses. "That's right," said Arnold. "One time I went to see Robbie pose. He got up there. I looked down to grab some popcorn. I looked up and he was gone." But Robbie is now well into his 12th pose at least, and the crowd is, in the vernacular of sports, eating it up. It is different when you see it on television. One can see that on the faces of the naive and gaping women out there who have put up the ducats to see this incredible mass of storybook tissue personified. And the men, they are shouting banshee noises up at Robbie. Soon it is over. The crowd is cheering. They have just seen the next Mr. Universe. But the cheering is far less than what they give when the master of ceremonies, resplendent in rented tux, announces, "And now the person we've all been waiting for, the man." From where your reporter sits, he can see Arnold standing just at the edge of the stage, slightly hidden by the curtain, smiling. He allows the noise to rise slightly, and then he makes a slow, precise walk towards the carpeted platform, splashed with a pool of yellow light. It is spontaneous, these poses he starts to hit. He has told your reporter that. The routine transcends mere grace. It goes beyond mere power. It is the finest combination of the two, and it particularly hits you when Arnold swings into his version of Rodin's Thinker. This is your reporter's first glimpse of the man live, doing what no one does better. Now comes the dawn. Robbie had stated it earlier. It really is Arnold that is the highest form of charisma in bodybuilding. His feats have been chronicled in journals about the world. He is our most famous son. The crowd demands two encores before it is sated. With each return to the platform, Arnold speeds his poses, stressing the dramatic. He's got them now. The crowd is his. They've been his since the first posters were erected. They're his wherever he goes. The end. What a great article. Thanks to Jack Neary for that great article from Muscle Builder and Power. Thanks you guys for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. We will see you next week for part two of our interview with Boyer Co. We'll see you then. Take care, everybody.